Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
And welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuelner. Ruben Stern is on vacation this week. Columbia may be in the midst of a transformation. Local civic and business leaders are attempting to set up an enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia. Today you'll hear us call it an EEZ for short. The program, which is administered by the State Department of Economic Development, would offer business incentives to attract new companies to the area. But not everyone agrees on the idea. To qualify for the state program, an area needs to be designated as blighted. That's raised many eyebrows within the community. Some are also concerned that the declaration of blight could be used as rationale to take over private property through eminent domain. So, how will an enhanced enterprise zone affect Columbia? What will the blight designation entail, and how has the program worked out in other communities? To find out, I'm joined by a panel that spent a lot of time thinking about these questions. Bernie Andrews is the Executive Vice President for Regional Economic Development, Inc. The organization has been pushing for the establishment of an EEZ in Columbia. Bernie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Greg Williams is the director of the University of Missouri System Research Parks. The organization aims to promote business development in partnership with research programs at the university. Before becoming director, Williams led the economic development program for the Springfield, Missouri Chamber of Commerce. Greg, welcome to the show today.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And Tracy Griever Rice is the interim director for the MU Office of Social and Economic Data Analysis. She's also involved with the Citizens Involved and Invested in Columbia, for short, it's CIVIC. It's a grassroots organization that emerged in response to the enhanced enterprise zone push. Tracy, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right. And we hope to hear from you and the audience as well. What do you think of the idea of enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925, email us at intersection@kbi.org, or you can join our online chat. Now, really, to start this, I think it's a good idea just for those who aren't as familiar with the concept of an EEZ to explain a little bit about what it is. Bernie, maybe you can help us out what an enhanced enterprise zone is and how it's used in the state of Missouri.
Sure. Well, first of all, we call it a jobs program. It is a state tax credit program that offers tax credits to businesses that locate in a geographic zone, and that zone is defined by population, unemployment, and poverty. And so it's also a partnership program. It works with the local community. The community looks at the qualifying census block groups in the community, decides which one are important economic development efforts, and can apply for to become an enhanced enterprise zone. The other part of that is that when a community participates, for a company that qualifies with the right type of company in the zone, the local community has to agree to abate 50% of the real property taxes on the project. All the other personal property taxes are collected 100%. Everything that is in place before the business expands is also collected at 100%.
Okay. And these aren't too rare in Missouri.
No, they're everywhere. They're all around us. There's 118 enhanced enterprise zones. There are, I believe, 29 more in the works. All the surrounding counties around us have enterprise zones, including Jefferson City. And when you think of enterprise zone or enhanced enterprise zone, some people, because of the, you know, we've already got the word out there, blight, they think of a, you know, very blighted area. If you go down to Jefferson City, for example, and cross the bridge, turn immediate left and go towards the state capitol, you're in an enhanced enterprise zone, that whole area there. So that may surprise some people. Okay. It's really, to keep in mind, a zone for job creation.
Okay. So where is this in the process? Obviously, like I said, you have to declare these blighted areas, and then it has to go back to the state, I guess.
Yes, and we're probably still early in the process. You first have to, as a community, work with the Department of Economic Development and produce what they call a run to see if you have the area that meets the minimum standards. From there, you order a map, and then you can kind of work with your map to add, subtract. But once that's done, you have to go to through city council process. They have to create an enhanced enterprise zone board, and at the same time, they have to pass a resolution that says the area qualifies as an enhanced enterprise zone. And then this is where it gets interesting, because the state statute, they give you the phrase that, and I'll even read it here, that says some characteristics of blight or inadequacies that lead to blight. So it's somewhat of a nebulous terminology there that we, by looking at other enhanced enterprise zone applications, feel we can have met the standard and can meet the standard.
Okay. And so, and we have a map. It's a little outdated now because, as you said, it's so early in the process, things are being adjusted. But originally, the original proposal contained, from what I've seen reported, 60% of the city of Columbia.
I don't know in terms of actual geography. Mm-hmm. Had the original map had 41,000 residents in it, so just under 40% of the population was included in there. Let me finish my thought there on the process, though. So now an Enhanced Enterprise Zone Advisory Board is created, and they meet. They determine which businesses could be eligible to be in the zone. They determine the level abatement, and we're also letting them work on the map and see if that is the map that we want to take forward to the city council. And I'll tell you, we met Friday as a EEZ advisory board, and they've already shrunk the map by 6 census block groups, and have asked to take another one off. And then we essentially ran out of time so we could have some public comment. So we're in the process. Then we'll have to go to a public hearing, city council vote on it. If it passes, it goes to the county. And if the county passes it, then we can submit an application. And then from there, it takes whatever time it takes for the Department of Economic Development to pass it.
Okay. And Greg, we've worked with this in Springfield as well. This process obviously has drawn some contention here in Columbia. But how did the process go in Springfield and in its formation and then implementation, I guess?
Polar opposite, I would have to say. And I'll qualify first by saying I'm not a resident of Columbia. I've maintained my residence in Springfield and work proudly for the UM system and developing research parks and various assets across the state of Missouri. Leading the economic development program in Springfield in the 5-county metro for 15 years, this was a critical component of our economic development program, not just from the new attraction perspective of new business and industry, but of more importantly, we felt the existing industry and business base that was electing to expand operations and hire new people in the market. It's a tool. My selfish motivation and even being here today is the fact that Discovery Ridge Research Park along Highway 63 is proposed to within the geographic boundaries of Columbia's Enhanced Enterprise Zone. And that will offer, as I mentioned, a very important business development job creation tool in a tool chest, frankly, that's not very full. Columbia has not been known for being a real bastion of economic development, new attraction, and job creation for quite some time. With new leadership, particularly in the mayor's position and city council, they are clearly seeing the need to maintain competitiveness for new jobs and the capital investment that results. I say polar opposite in the fact that most of the, I refer to as missionary work, on the front end of the establishment and designation of the enterprise zone in Springfield, very detailed, honest conversations with public decision makers, the superintendent of schools, the director of the library district, the ambulance district, the various taxing districts that clearly understood that we're offering a 50% abatement of any improvements that are made to real property. Mm-hmm. That is constructing a facility on a greenfield parcel of ground.
And so you haven't seen that same transparency in Columbia, is what you're saying?
Transparency. I just think that from my understanding and various discussions with community leaders, that there seems to be a general distrust of government and individuals that are utilizing scare tactics in the term blight. and perhaps even suggesting that eminent domain could be a result of the designation. I've read the statute. I've read it dozens of times, and even have just this weekend. And for the life of me, cannot find the term eminent domain in the enterprise zone statute at the state level. So I think that's just a scare tactic of those who may perhaps have a no growth or a slow growth mentality as it relates to economic development at the local level.
Yeah. I do have to take a second to remind our listeners that you're listening to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Familiner, filling in for Reuben Stern. Today we're talking about the proposal for an enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia, which would provide tax incentives for new businesses in Columbia. But some residents are concerned about the implications it might have, specifically in declaring much of the city blighted. Our guests in the studio today are Bernie Andrews, the Executive Vice President for Regional Economic Development, Inc., Greg Williams, who's the Director of the University of Missouri System Research Parks and previously was involved with the EEZ in Springfield, Missouri, and Tracy Griever Rice, who's involved with Civic, a grassroots organization that emerged in response to the EEZ push. And for you in our audience, does Columbia need an EEZ to bring in business? Let us know what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection's presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2, online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2, online at kbia.org. Okay, so Tracy, let's bring you in the conversation here. Greg was just alluding to that there has been some opposition to this. At first, the word blight is what alerted a lot of people. You're involved with Civic, not necessarily a spokesperson, I understand, but involved with Civic. What are some of the main concerns you have personally, and also concerns you've seen from others in that group?
Thank you. I think there are a couple of things to keep in mind is that there are really two pieces of this program, and most of the concern has to do with the application and the organization of the EEZ. Most of the folks that I've talked to really don't have a huge problem with the abatement issue. Now, there is a group of folks who are concerned with that and think we need to be thoughtful about where we encourage tax abatement and get the right mix or tools in the toolbox, as Greg mentioned. But the primary concern that I've run into is people who are worried about what the designation of blight will do to their own property values and their neighborhoods more generally, as well as the concern about using the 2000 census data, which is, you know, collected more than a dozen years ago now, as the criteria. And I think the other, what else do I want to say? There are also those who are concerned that the way the resolution was passed for blighting Columbia, and there are people, I've heard people argue both ways whether that's actually happened or not, but that it happened by resolution as opposed to by ordinance. And there's some very clear language in this charter of the City of Columbia about how to go about the legislative process, including the public hearing process and input process. And we didn't do it this time. The blight was declared and the committee established, and Jeremy Root, who lives here in Columbia and is an attorney in Jeff City, did a little research, looked at all 53 boards and commissions, how they were established. Of those, only 8 were established via resolution, and 4 of those have been established via resolution since Mayor McDavid took office. So he's taking us in a new direction in terms of the public opportunity for public input process, and I think that makes people nervous.
I mean, Greg, is it fair to say that you got ready and the city didn't necessarily expect this much discussion?
You mean Bernie?
Bernie, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very fair to say. You know, when we've been doing the research on this program, first of all, we've been looking at incentives since 2002. But, you know, looking hard at this program since about June, contacted many of the existing enhanced enterprise zones to ask what are the issues. You know, what are the issues you faced? You know, generally, what's the public hearing process? Who shows up? By and large, as Tracy mentioned, the big issue is it's tax abatement when you get right down to it, and some people philosophically are, you know, against it. So we thought that would be the big issue. We spent time talking with the different taxing districts, you know, library board and conversation with the school board and things like that to get their, you know, that they understood the program. There was, a couple of years ago, one community that thought that the program could lead to eminent domain. They brought in, the comments from a bond counsel, bond attorney out of St. Louis, and they ultimately passed that. But, no, I would say we're absolutely, or have been surprised at the thought that, it could lower property values. And maybe, I understand it. Certainly, if you're a homeowner and you see the word, blight or inadequacies that lead to blight, what does that mean? What's that going to do? I understand that. But it has not been brought to our attention in any other zones that was going to come up.
Greg, any experience? Is there any experience anybody at the table know if there's anything to prove that or disprove that? I mean, I haven't – from what I've read, there's not much research to show.
There is some research, particularly a very good article by an author whose last name is Dana out of the University of Chicago, who talks about the disproportionate impact of the declarations of blight on low and moderate income neighborhoods. If you're living in a house or operating a business in a new strip mall or a new subdivision, and it's very apparent that it is not, quote unquote, blighted, then there's not really any impact on your property value. If you're in older historic neighborhoods where houses might be older, the footprint might be smaller. People used to live in older and in smaller houses than we expect today. Streets were narrow because they were built prior to the standards that exist today. Sewer, rainwater might be a little bit older. Those folks are more likely, this gentleman argues, to be disproportionately impacted in terms of property value and their ability to react to the blight designation and then other people would be. So it's partly it's a social justice issue about where do we implement this so that we are not burdening people with the least ability to protect themselves.
Great.
And to your question, a couple of thoughts. Blight is a word. It's a term that I frankly think the State Department of Economic Development should reconsider. Perhaps soften or eliminate the word completely because it does have negative connotation.
I think we both agree on that.
And let me tell you, in my 15, 20 years experience of doing projects, nearly $500 million of new capital investment just in Springfield alone over the time I was there and nearly 10,000 net new jobs within the zone. The word blight, if it was ever used, was used more as a word of opportunity. And not disproportionate share of property values, or an opportunity to enhance the neighborhood, and an opportunity to make dramatic public infrastructure improvements, whether it's natural gas, sewer, stormwater, what it may be as a result of the development process with and for industries that have selected your community in which to make a major investment and hire people. So, in fact, in a previous job from that of what I did in Springfield, I blighted a cornfield for a new development. A cornfield was considered as part of the language in the statute, blight, but more from the obsolescence perspective and not dilapidation by any means. It's hard to have a dilapidated cornfield.
Okay.
And got the obsolescence language approved through a Chapter 353, the Urban Redevelopment Corporation, and created higher and better use. The farmer who owned the land got a tremendous amount of more per acre than he would have maintaining it in corn from private sector developers who created a regional distribution facility.
Okay.
So it's all in the interpretation.
Well, I was going to say, so and I think when you hear the word blighted, and maybe this is part of the concern that, you think of places like maybe East St. Louis or Detroit, in nomenclature anyway. That's the way the impression first hits you. So is it fair to say that even though we're using this word, maybe parts of Columbia that might be in this zone aren't considered blighted by the tradition, by a nomenclature sense?
Well, when you look at the application for the program, it really, in the application, tends to use blight and or distress, kind of uses that qualifier. And, really our interest in this is because we are in Columbia in the zone suffering what I would call some distress. We talked about the loss of manufacturing jobs, 1,500 jobs or so in the last 10 years. Those were benefited full-time positions that, don't exist anymore. We have not had new investment in industrial zoned land and M1 general zoning in the last 4 years. And the last real major plant that's located here in a greenfield site was really Quaker Oats, which is now PepsiCo. We've had replacement facilities, companies that come in and take existing buildings because they were readily available, but just have not been competitive in bringing in the new industrial employment. And again, we're looking at, you know, technology jobs. We're looking at IT jobs. We're looking also at manufacturing jobs. We're a diverse community. We feel that we need the full spectrum of jobs. But the other part of that distress is the poverty indicators. You know, the free and reduced lunch is up. Utility assistance to people requesting utility assistance, medicine assistance from the city, food bank assistance, and all that type of thing. So there is what I would say more distress. There is obviously some blight. I mean, you have to have the terminology blight, which could be, you know, inadequate sidewalks or crumbling sidewalks. You know, we know a lot of the storm sewer under Columbia is close to 100 years old. So, I mean, there's obviously some blight that we can prove, but it's more of the distress that has us worried.
And
at this
frankly,
time.
Those are the people who are living in those distressed, quote-unquote, neighborhoods who are going to benefit most from the designation, from new influx of jobs that business and industry bring to this region. And it's important also to at least maintain that we're not in any sense of the word suggesting sweepstakes game that gets played by so many larger cities on the big national projects where the abatement is 100% forever. And you look at dollar to job ratios of public monies that really at the local level that get spent that are just ridiculous. This we're talking about a program that abates 50% of any new improvement made to real estate. So the argument that we make and have made with various taxing districts that you're going to get 50% of something versus 100% of nothing on top of 100% of your personal property taxes. More often than not, in the office deals, the back office, even in some manufacturing settings, the amount of personal property taxes that are paid on machinery and equipment, furniture and fixtures, can be awfully close, not all the time, but can be awfully close to the tax bill on the facility. The school district can generate 70% of every personal property tax dollar that's paid by these tech-oriented firms, these manufacturers, office tenants that are new to the market. So we're talking about 50% of something that's very, very valuable as opposed to a greenfield that may be generating $14 per acre per year in real estate taxes.
Right. Tracy, I saw you.
That's
curious to jump in there.
That's a little bit of an assumption in an argument, the either nothing or 50% of something or 100% of nothing. That assumes that no other kind of economic development tool could work. It assumes that local businesses wouldn't grow and expand, and that's probably not entirely fair. I also wanted to mention briefly and talk a little bit about the way the data represent Columbia accurately and doesn't represent Columbia accurately. Because of our disproportionate population of students and people between 18 and 24, we have in some cases what I would call situational poverty, people who appear poor when they're asked by the census because they're students and working part-time jobs, taking out loans, that kind of thing, when in fact they're attached to middle-income households throughout the state of Missouri and from other places. And what the EEZ program is trying to correct is structural poverty, is true poverty. So even using the 2000 data, when I look at the block groups in the central city, there are only two of them that remain as qualifying for the EEZ program. When you look at all households, if you look at just families, people that are related to each other, so probably not that 18 to 24 student demographic, then you're looking at poverty rates in the 25% range and even below 20%. So I think mostly as we work through this process, and I generally am totally good with the idea of an EEZ for our existing industrial parks and research parks and shovel-ready sites. That's all great. That's a resource to create manufacturing and other kinds of economic-based businesses that bring resources in from outside Columbia to Columbia so we can turn those dollars over and over again. But what I'm not in favor of is sort of being disingenuous with the data to shape a part of the city to be included that would likely never have manufacturing in it again, and is done through misrepresentation. So I kind of feel like there are two agendas going on here, one of them perfectly legitimate and one of them that has to do with Central City redevelopment that certainly in some cases need to be done. For example, look at the old OSCO site, but needs to be done in a thoughtful, open, public, transparent way where the people who are there now get to have some input into how it happens. So, you know, regardless of what the application requires, I think we need to have a conversation about which of these block groups in the central city really qualify as blighted and in poverty when you look at the actual data specific to the people who are invested there for the long term.
And back to the assumptions that in the response, and some of those are valid assumptions. The Enterprise Zone program, however, the Enhanced Enterprise Zone program, may be recognized as the most fundamental business development tool the state of Missouri offers. Now, certainly there are low-interest loan programs through the SBA at the federal level and perhaps even some grant programs still available through DNR or the State Economic Development Department, but the most fundamental assistance, and it's not immediate, but it's when you create jobs, when you hire people at attractive salaries and pay more than 50% of their health insurance benefits, you then are eligible for this benefit. I have had, again, on the assumptions, I've had dozens of new employers look at me and tell me to my face, we would not have made this investment. We would not have located on this site in this community but for the program. In one case, T-Mobile built a $17 million office facility in Northwest Springfield several years ago and hired 750 people at some very attractive wage rates and looked at me and said this investment would not have been made but for the offering of the Enhanced Enterprise Zone program. Certainly there are others. Chapter 100 is a bond policy that's in place in Columbia. And there's 353 Urban Redevelopment Corporation and other programs. But we're talking about the most fundamental business assistance program the state of Missouri, I think, has ever offered.
And Bernie, getting back to her point of do you think this has been enough public input in the process, specifically in those populations that she addressed?
Probably not yet, but we're certainly engaged now and looking forward to do that. When we first did this, we had a ready subcommittee take a look at what are the assets we need to get into the Enhanced Enterprise Zone, including our existing manufacturers that have been good corporate citizens for years, the shovel-ready sites, Discovery Ridge, the larger office sites. Originally, downtown was added for a couple reasons, proximity to the three colleges. It was thought that maybe the tech companies that were looking at us and still are might have a interest in being in a downtown environment close to the campuses, and also as possible for a possible location for some sort of a tourism type project. And so that was the original thought of putting downtown in. But I think really all the census block groups right now are up for discussion with the advisory board, and we'd certainly welcome your recommendations and maybe your data there to do that at one of the upcoming meetings to take a look at that. So,
We're going to have to take a quick break. Okay. Sorry to interrupt, cut you off there. But this is, remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the proposal for an enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia, which would provide tax incentives for new businesses in Columbia. But some residents are concerned about the implications it might have, specifically in declaring much of the city blighted. Our guests in the studio today are Bernie Andrews, the Executive Vice President for Regional Economic Development, Inc., Greg Williams, who's the director of University of Missouri Research, and Tracy Griever Rice. We'll be right back here after the short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, filling in for Ruben Stern. Today, we're talking about the proposal for an enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia, which would provide tax incentives for new businesses in Columbia. Our guests in the studio today are Bernie Andrews, the Executive Vice President for Regional Economic Development, Inc., Greg Williams, who's the Director of the University of Missouri System Research Parks and previously was involved with the EEZ in Springfield, Missouri, and Tracy Griever Rice, who's involved with Civic, a grassroots organization that emerged in response to the EEZ push. And for you in our audience, do you think an EEZ will change Columbia? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925. Email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can join our online chat. Okay, so we do have a question from our from one of our listeners. It is Pat Fowler. I don't know if some of you are familiar with her. But it was regarding some of our earlier conversation. Basically, it was talking more about some of these groups. She says, Columbia has lots of entry-level jobs that pay between $8 and $10 an hour. How do you respond to concerns that living wages are few and far between for a large portion of Columbia, not because we're blighted or in poverty, but because of large employer policies to keep strong wages for a top tier and mediocre wages for the rest of us? And then she says, well, I know this sounds personal. When was the last time you supported your family on an $11.44 an hour?
Okay. That's a good question. This job or this program, the minimum for a company to qualify for benefits and for the tax abatement is 75% of the county average wage, which is $11.44 an hour. But in reality, sometimes that just, you know, starting wage for some manufacturing is above there, and certainly after a few years, it's much higher than that. But the other factors there that the company has to offer health insurance and pay 51% of health insurance. And so, you know, there's...
That's actually an interesting question. Is the benefit based on 75% of the county wage with or without benefits?
Without benefits,
without.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. And then, I mean, we kind of got to this point earlier, too, but, you know, we Columbia brought in IBM. Obviously, that was a lot of jobs. You talked about the fact that this is a tool, but is the EEZ really essential to bringing jobs into Columbia? I mean, could it be done without it? It was done without it. I mean, I think maybe that's one of the – I know I've seen some of that as a concern. Like, what's the point? Why do this?
Well, I would say it's essential. When you look at IBM, for example, there was incentives used in that program. Mm-hmm. And at first, we had two shots at the IBM project. The first time it looked at us, it liked the workforce here. We spent a lot of time proving the workforce. The offer we made to them for a facility was pretty much a market rate facility. And they went somewhere else because there was a very attractive building location. So when they came back to us, we knew that it was going to take a very attractive building proposition in order to get them to locate here. And so this is where, you know, an EEZ might have been a good tool. It turns out the city stepped up in a local bank consortium in order to kind of monetize some other benefits from the state and made that deal work. But, it was very much an incentive-driven project. We have lost many other projects because the type of incentives we have, quality jobs, works good for more technology or technology jobs. Chapter 100 is a good program. You get to the same point. You get a 50% abatement for 10 years, but the county owns your asset during that time period. With a new company coming in, that may not be too problematic, but for an existing company that may have a 100,000-square-foot facility and they're going to expand by 50,000 square feet, it's very problematic to give title to a whole facility over to the county. So we have had some tools, but as Greg mentioned, this EEZ is an easier tool to use.
So a business has actually told you we would have located here had you had more incentives?
Oh, the last two projects that we lost, and one of them was, you know, an investment in hundreds of millions of dollars. One of the two factors during the, the debrief was your incentive program's a pain in the, you know what. And then the other factor we hear a lot is the airport. And so we're working now to try and address both of those weaknesses here.
Okay. And we do have a caller on the line, Mike Martin. We welcome you in. Mike, are you there?
Yeah. Can you all hear me?
Everybody got him?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Mike. What do you want to say today?
Well, a couple of things. I wanted to look at this from a more of a statewide perspective first, briefly. and then more locally, and again, fairly briefly. But looking around the state at the various EEZ zones that are statewide, and there are quite a few of them, you find that a great many of them, if not a majority, are in truly, truly impoverished areas, often in counties, in areas that really, and if you look at the state of Missouri, especially from the perspective that I have coming in here from out of state, lived here 15 years now, but grew up over on the coast. You know, Missouri, compared to the rest of the nation, is not necessarily a prosperous state. And you have a lot of counties here that are in very dire straits. And as I've grown to understand the EEZ program, the experts that I've talked to about it, what I've read about it, and the many, many counties that I've seen adopted around the state, it was designed to really deal with truly blighted, truly impoverished, truly economically starving areas. And in the state of Missouri, as I think everyone knows, Columbia is an economic oasis where a program like this is really not, was not designed for this area. Regardless how much, you know, our economic development people want to graft it on to Columbia, it was not designed for Columbia. And as Tom Green with the Department of Economic Development told me, he said, you know, you can get 118 enterprise zones in a 5-square block of North St. Louis because it is that blighted there. It's that impoverished. Same with Kansas City, same with a lot of the counties around the state. If you move down to Springfield, I don't know if one of your guests there says he worked there, but you should refer to the article that I just emailed you in the Springfield, I think it's the News Leader that Amos Bridges wrote back in June of last year, that talks about all the blighted areas that were forgotten in Springfield, formally declared blighted to redevelop the city, and how basically, you know, 5 decades of these things have left, you know, Springfield kind of a mess.
Okay.
When they were just uncovered recently.
All right, Mike, why don't we let Mike and Greg respond real quick, and we'll bring you back.
That I emailed you, if you would.
Okay.
And
okay.
I'd be happy to read that. I vaguely do remember Amos's article. To refer to a community that has led not just state of Missouri economic development programs and the number of new projects and net new job creation, and has realized $500 million, $500 million of new investment within the boundaries of the zone. And we're talking about just 1/3 of the city, primarily across the northern tier of Springfield from one major master planned industrial park, heavy industrial park center, across the I-44 corridor to another major master planned industrial park facility next to a new $250 million airport facility and new terminal. To be considered a mess would be somewhat misleading, and would think that, again, there are plenty of other articles, some that Amos, I'm sure, has written as well, that celebrate the economic development success stories and job creation success stories that community, of which I still call home, has enjoyed. So again, that's back. You're focusing on a term, on a word, blight, that in many respects in the business in which we operate, in economic development, national business recruitment and attraction, would be a word that can mean other things. It can mean a variety of things, and I think it does mean a variety of things. It perhaps could be a North St. Louis, which, to your point, is experiencing some tremendous problems and tremendous challenges. But it also can be a word that denotes opportunity and reinvestment in those neighborhoods and capital investment in those neighborhoods, whether they be industrial or residential, in the improvements that are made in public infrastructure and new corridors. And
I understand, but with all due respect, sir, the blight designations in Springfield have been going on since 1964, where Amos points out that the city has deemed 1,133.14 acres of Springfield blighted over the course of, 47 years. And he talks about all the many redevelopment plans that took off in Springfield and failed. In fact, there's a subtitle in this called All These Plans Fall Through.
And where the mayor is saying that just now, after all these years, 47 years, all these blight designations are starting to actually return something to the city.
Well, we're talking about two different things.
The other point I want to make, and I think it's important, is that don't confuse the idea that blight has many definitions. It does not. It is very, very formally, legally defined in state statute, including the statute that governs the enterprise zone formula. It has six different sub-definitions. It's very well spelled out, and it's not subject. It's not up for discussion about what it means legally. It means what it says in the law, and what it says in the law doesn't really apply to Columbia, Missouri.
And with all due respect, Columbia is making those decisions for Columbia, Missouri. The ordinance in Springfield provided us at the local level. We're not talking about the state statute. And frankly, sir, with all due respect, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about economic development zones where industry can locate major new plant facilities, offices, call centers, you name it. We're not talking about neighborhood redevelopment. The city has done a very poor job in many of those neighborhoods in that community. But we're talking about two completely different things here.
But you're not, because the Ready program has essentially located this enterprise zone in the middle of a number of residential neighborhoods where the kinds of development you're talking about wouldn't be appropriate.
Okay.
This is part of the issue with this. The other point I wanted to make was that I realize that you're not from this area, but three times in the past, in the recent past, the last 50 years, plans that include blight designations for economic redevelopment have been extremely contentious, and two of the three fell through, with the third one doing a lot of damage to the black business community here.
Okay.
All of those programs were redevelopment incentives based on blight designations, one downtown called the Midtown Redevelopment Plan, another one called the Flat Branch Redevelopment Plan, and the third most devastating one called the Douglas School Urban Renewal Project. So when you look at the history of these programs in Columbia, you have an additional layer of contention, an additional layer of community concern that I think the way that this has been handled so far has really pretty much completely ignored.
All right. Mike,
what more can one say about this?
All right, Mike, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much.
And Bernie, I'll let you, respond to that on how the history of blight designations went into this decision-making. I mean, I don't know if it did.
Well, first of all, I appreciate Mr. Martin's comments, and we do look forward to get more involvement as we move forward here with the EZ Advisory Board and some of the community meetings we've been invited to. I think we've got a very good committee, receptive to listening to taking out portions of the map and the proposed zone. Just at the advisory board meeting on Friday, they took out six, asked for another one to be looked at to see if it could be removed. And, you know, there may have been more come off, except that we ran out of time so we could have some public comments. So we do look forward to, you know, Tracy working with you to give some suggestions. And I think the advisory board will do a good job and listen and involve you in the process.
Have there been, instead of doing a large swath that we've done here of the enterprise zone, was there ever a discussion of breaking up into smaller zones, targeting certain areas that might actually be the spots that you'll have development?
Yeah, there was some thought to that, but you never know what the next project is going to be. Plus, the different sites we have around town have different infrastructures and are suited for different types of businesses. Plus, we have, you know, in Columbia, the manufacturers are kind of spread out. You have manufacturers on Route B, Lamone Industrial, but in the north part of Columbia, north of I-70, you have companies like Watlow that have facilities which have kind of been now developed commercial. So we didn't really want to penalize those type of employers that have also invested here for a long time. So it's a balancing act.
But is it not true that the boundaries of the zone are required to be contiguous?
Yes, they are.
That you can't necessarily have, I guess you could make application for five or six subzones within the community, but the statute does read that the boundaries must be all within the same geographic contiguous area.
Right.
Right. So it appears when you look at the map of where the EEZs are in the state of Missouri that there is almost a rural model and an urban model. And if you look at St. Louis County, St. Louis City, Jackson County, I believe Clay and the general Kansas City metro area region is included, and Greene County. They've gone with a more urbanized model where there are multiple EEZs that are clearly for very specific block groups where there's need. And, you know, everyone in Columbia jumped up and down, and we had a big proclamation when we hit 100,000. And we need to decide if we're urban or rural and perhaps take some advice from our more urbanized centers in the state as terms of targeted areas where there's minimal impact on the surrounding neighborhoods and other kinds of land uses and property owners.
I am going to take one more time to remind our listeners that are listening to Intersection right now. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumuller, filling in for Reuben Stern. Today we're talking about the proposal for an enhanced enterprise zone in Columbia, which would provide tax incentives for new businesses. But some residents are concerned about the implications it might have, specifically in declaring much of the city blighted. Our guests in the studio today are Bernie Andrews, the Executive Vice President for Regional Economic Development, Inc., Greg Williams, who is the Director of the University of Missouri System Research Parks and was previously involved with the EEZ in Springfield, Missouri, and Tracy Griever-Rice, who's involved with Civic, a grassroots organization that emerged in response to the EEZ push. And for you in our audience, what questions do you have about the proposal for an EEZ in Columbia and its possible implications, positive or negative? Give us a call at 573-882-8925, email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can join our online chat. We do have a couple questions from our chat room. One of them had to do with the original map. Again, we've talked about how the fact that it's been kind of pared down at this point, but Jeremy Root asked, why is all of downtown and Jesse Hall included in the current blight zone approved by the City Council on February 6th? And I don't know if that's true on the most recent map, but
it is.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why is downtown?
Why is downtown, all of downtown and Jesse Hall included in the blight designation?
Well, that was, again, the smallest unit you can go is a census block group. And when the original EEZ subcommittee met, University of Missouri is a big part of the economic development of the future. I mean, there's a huge push for technology development, entrepreneurship, and downtown is, in close proximity to all three colleges. So that was some of the rationale for putting downtown into the group in the first place.
When you take a look at the block group level data from the 2000 census in terms of poor persons living in families and families below poverty, neither block group 5.01 or 5.02 come near meeting the criteria for the program. The percent of poor persons in families is about 28% in 501, about 20% in 502, and when you look at families living below poverty, it's a quarter to less than 20%. So once you take out that student population, this part of downtown Columbia does not qualify for the program.
Any response to that, Bernie? I mean, is it more advantageous in applying for EEZs because there is such a large student population in Columbia?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there is. Again, I'll say the same thing. I mean, the advisory board welcome and will continue discussion on what stays in and what goes out. So if you want to share some of that data with me, I will provide it to them so that they take that into consideration. We did meet last Friday as an advisory board. There's a meeting this Friday coming up. And then because of the information session, people wanted to have this group also meet at night, so we've agreed to at least hold, one of the meetings in the future at night, too. So there will be additional meetings. So
one thing that spurred a lot of this that we haven't really talked a whole lot about today is eminent domain and the use of the word blight when eminent domain is used. Is there a history of that of it being used through an EEZ? I don't know if there's enough history. I mean, the program's not quite old enough, I wouldn't think, to have a documented history. But what's the concern there? I mean,
it's misinformation is my concern, because as I stated earlier, and to not be disrespectful to or discourteous, that's not the intent. But read the statute, and come back and show us where the power of eminent domain is allowable through the Enhanced Enterprise Zone statute. Now, there's a statute, certainly, on the books of every state that allows government to utilize the authority for public purposes. But we're talking about oil and water. There is no reference in the enterprise zone language that would provide even the idea that a political subdivision like the City of Columbia or Boone County would ever Certainly they have the authority, but not through the statute that allows enterprise zone benefits to be designated to new employers.
Tracy, you would look like you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I think there is the concern about blight is influenced and colored by other experiences that have happened in Columbia. It was just a few years ago that the last council meeting before Christmas, after all of the students had gone and people were well into moving into their holiday time, that the attempt was made to blight the area where Bengals Bar and Grill is. And, you know, that was a controversy between a bunch of families that probably all belong to the same country club. And I think people were rather taken back by the willingness of the council and staff at the time to try and move that through and the timing that it did, and for the people that were involved. And in some ways, I think, my personal opinion is it was more of a sort of testing of the waters to see how the community would respond to that kind of redevelopment process. And, you know, people were ticked. It was it was a bad deal. And that's partly what's coloring this process, too. It's use of a synonym. But I would also say to Greg that the definition of blight is used across statutes for different kinds of programs. So from one end, you can argue that blight is blight is blight, and the other one you can say, but it's different for each of these programs, so it's not the same thing. And that's the kind of – those are the kind of questions that get sorted out in court. Mm-hmm. And then my question becomes, who in the process is most privileged to be able to manage to sort those things out in court? And private developers can do whatever they want, but as a community, as a public entity, we have a responsibility to make sure that playing field is level.
I have a very similar experience, and I keep referencing Springfield. That's my source of reference today in this conversation. But a very privileged mayor, also a very successful attorney who practices law in the city, lost his mayoral race due to a threat that he had made to exercise the city's power of eminent domain to take a family dairy farm for industrial purposes. That was a tragic, and in his case, a fatal mistake, a political fatality for Mayor Ganaway at the time. He lost the next election in a landslide because he made that threat. But we're talking about two things. We're talking about the power of eminent domain, and we're talking about enhanced enterprise zone designation. And really, it would take a tremendous amount of creativity to find that eminent domain authority in a crossover discussion
I can assure you, in Reddy's discussion with this program, and our only intention is to do two things: bring some new employers into the vacant industrial land so we have jobs and we have a better tax base, and help our existing manufacturers and employers expand with a benefit that they don't currently get right now.
Just one more thing. It was very interesting at the public meeting last week where Mrs. Shoemaker from DED gave her presentation. When Mayor McDavid opened the meeting, he said that the goal was to only use eminent domain for linear easements for utilities and that sort of thing. If the EEZ application and the ordinance to pass it was written, that it specified that that was the only kind of eminent domain that would be used in those census block groups, for the duration of the enterprise zone, enhanced enterprise zone, I think that would relieve a lot of people's stress and mind. Just making a very public and legal commitment to only doing linear easements.
The city did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at the advisory board meeting on Friday, there was a motion for the EEZ advisory board to recommend to the city council that you cannot use this program or the blight definition or declaration under the EEZ in eminent domain. So that will be a recommendation we'll go forward. That would have to be a city council decision, though.
Those things are helpful, and because it makes the policy position behind the ordinance very clear. It makes it clear where the community was coming from. But their long-term validity is are worked out in court.
Hmm. We do have a question from the chat room that we have an issue we haven't gotten to either, but it's from Steve. He says, those folks whose status and location qualifies Columbia for the EEZ, i.e. poverty and poor infrastructure, how will the proposal ensure that those folks and areas benefit significantly through these types of economic incentives?
It won't. I mean, not directly.
The people who qualify the program, the ones that are, you know, mm-hmm.
Okay.
are in poverty.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. Well, you could do actually put some extra incentive into the program or the local policy to encourage people to hire from certain census block groups or areas or, for example, hire veterans. Once you define your boundaries and your codes, if they qualify for the tax credits, you have to give them the 50% for 10 years. But, for example, in Springfield, if a company gets a silver or LEED certification, they give them an extra 25%. What we could do, and in fact the committee started talking about that the other day, maybe there are some, you know, if a company provides transportation or if a company, you know, hires from a certain group, that maybe look at building in a little extra incentive for them to do that. So that's certainly on the table and something they consider.
Okay. Is that something, I mean, Tracy, it sounded like that was an important issue to you. I mean, is that the fact that they're even talking about it?
That is an important issue that has come up over and over from a variety of people in terms of the civic group, and which is a very diverse group. And I've been doing community level, you know, involvement in Columbia for a long time. And this is the most diverse group of folks in terms of the geography of where they're at in the community and the diversity of perspectives. And it's truly a sort of politics makes strange bedfellows kind of group. But I think that's going to be a very strong strong piece of it.
And that group does have a meeting coming up this week, I believe, right?
Wednesday night, I think.
Okay. Where is it in case people are interested in talking more about this?
I am so embarrassed. I don't know the answer to that right off the top of my head.
That's
but
fine. We'll
hopefully
have you,
someone will write that.
Somebody
in.
Put it in the chat.
I know that it's at Parkade.
Parkade.
And I believe it's at 7.
That sounds right. Okay. Well, I wanted to close. There is a comment from the chat room that I thought kind of wrapped this up pretty well. It was from an anonymous source, so we can't say who it came from. But they said that in the short term, the introduction of the EEZ has increased distrust and hostility between citizens and their elected representatives. In the medium or long term, it's difficult to predict at this stage how or whether it will change Columbia. If the final zones are appropriately targeted industrial areas and the incentives are successful to attracting our growing businesses, it could be very positive. Would everybody agree with that?
Well said.
Yeah. Comment.
And how likely is that from each of your standpoints in 15 seconds where this is now? I mean, it sounds like they're opening up some dialogue.
I think it's entirely possible. Again, I think there are a couple different agendas going on, and I think if we get focused on the economic base and growing our local economy agenda, that we're all going to be good.
Bernie, seems like you guys are, I mean, from what you've said numerous times today, you're open to hearing what people have to say.
I would agree. This is all about the job creation and helping correct some of those indicators that are going the wrong way right now. So if that takes some negotiation and some working together and figuring out a good way to do it, I think we're all for it.
Okay. Well, that is all the time we have for today. We want to thank all of our guests, Bernie Andrews, Greg Williams, and Tracy Grieber-Rice. We'd also like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Melanie Gibson. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Fumuhlner, filling in for Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.